to Crutchfield.
Hello, hello, hello.
Hi, I'm Paul.
I'm Stephen.
Together we're
Living Villa Cabelli.
Yes, we are.
And today we have an actual very special guest. Let me give you a little intro here. So it's not going to be just us here today. You're going to have a little bit more entertainment. But our guest tonight is a writer. He's written such books as Live Like an Italian and Eat Like an Italian. His blog, which is actually, I highly recommend, guys. It's actually very entertaining. Has received top honors in both 2014 and 2015 from Italy Magazine. He has a passion from all things Italian, which basically stems from his Italian-American heritage, which we'll ask him about. But he now keeps a foot firmly planted in both America and Italy. So he's a little bit expat here, just like us. And now he has a very cute two-year-old daughter who is helping him improve his Italian, who I'm going to hire as my tutor very soon, I'm sure. And ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, I present to you Rick Zullo.
Hey, how you guys doing today? Great to be here.
Well, thank you, yes. Rick. Great to have you here. Yes. You're like
that was a wonderful introduction. Thank you so much.
Stephen does his homework.
I try.
That's right.
I like doing that stuff. It's fun. I feel like I'm on like Johnny Carson or something, right? Introducing the guest.
Well, no, it's a real honor because I love your podcast I've been following you for a while, and it's an honor to be here talking to you guys today. I love what you're doing down in Puglia.
Thank you very much.
Well, my first question is Zullo. Where's your background?
Thank you. Yes. Well, my great grandfather, Giovanni Zullo, came to the U.S. At the beginning of the 20th century. He was from a small town in Molise called Bagnoli di Trigno. And I actually went there once about 5 or 6 years ago to look up the old family name in the registry there. And I was able to find him. And, it was pretty cool.
What part of the States did he immigrate to?
Well, he made a brief stop, I guess, to drop off some mozzarella and salami in New York, and then he moved on to Chicago from there. So that's where my family eventually settled. It was in the Chicago area, kind of on the west side. Cicero, we all know where Al Capone was from. That's actually where the area where my family was settled. So I grew up there until I was about 8, and then the family moved us down to Florida.
Were you born in Italy or the U.S.?
No. I was born in Chicago.
Okay.
And in fact, my parents and grandparents were both born in Chicago. My great grandparents were born in Italy.
I thought that maybe, which Molise really isn't that far from Puglia anyway, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Where we are, there's a very famous chef in Puglia in the Foggia area, by the name of Beppe Zullo.
Heard of him. Yes, yeah. I've heard of him.
Yeah, he's absolutely. Very famous here. Yeah.
Well, I'll show up at his restaurant one day and see if he'll give me the family treatment. I don't know. But, I've heard of him. In fact, a friend of mine, she seems to know him. I mean, she's like a food blogger, and she seems to know him. So
yeah, cool.
But anyway, yeah. So that's it. So I when I was growing up in Chicago, there was still that neighborhood. I think you guys, having lived in New York, you know that there are these neighborhoods still that, maybe they're now disappearing more so. But when I was growing up, where there was still sort of ethnically divided, the Italians lived in one area, the Polish lived in another.
I grew up in Boston when I moved from Italy, and it was totally, I lived in a mixed neighborhood, which means Italian and Irish. Mm-hmm. That's about as mixed as we got. South Boston was all Irish. The North End was all Italian. East Boston was all Italian. But, Italians, when they immigrated from Italy, set up their own ghettos. They literally were ghettos where they just lived, all among themselves. So in Chicago, where your great-grandfather moved to, were there other people in that area or in that neighborhood from either his town or Molise in general?
I'm not really sure about that because I didn't know him. I knew my great grandmother on the maternal side, and she was still alive when I was up until I was about 13. So she was from Calabria, a small town in Calabria, and I knew her. But my great grandfather, whose village that I eventually found, I never met him personally. In fact, he even died, when my dad was still a child. So he'd been dead a long time. But you know, there was still sort of that connection. I mean, you know, people, generations later, still refer to the old country, you know, people who had never set foot in the town, you know, in the country even, still very connected to the culture and into the way of life. So,
one of the, I think, cool things that even Italians are just realizing is that when these Italians left Italy and they moved to the States, and a lot of them did end up living in, you know, their own sort of closed neighborhoods, but, you know, mostly out of necessity. So, you know, they had people that they either knew from their own town or family members that were there. So they felt more comfortable. They could, you know, converse with people. They didn't feel totally at sea, if you will. But they brought with them all their old traditions that in the States, those traditions are still probably stronger than they are in Italy itself, because in Italy, they've changed over the years because there's an influx.
Let me say that, yeah.
You know, there's an influx of new traditions. There's an influx of, you know, more European things. Everything changed with World War II when, you know, the Allies came in. So, you know, there was more of a less of a language barrier. Whereas the Italians that went to America, those things remained in their, like I said earlier, the little ghettos, if you will, where, you know, in fact, there are scholars who go back to the U.S. and to places like Australia to find these Italian neighborhoods to recall what the original traditions in the original dialects actually were.
It's almost like a cultural time capsule. Yes. You're right, because they're separated from it. You know, they're not subjected to those forces of change that they would have been in Italy. So that's very interesting. Yeah, in fact, you know, when Italian Americans go back to Italy, so second or third generation, expecting to find what the stories that their great grandparents or grandparents told them, they don't find that because it doesn't exist anymore.
Exactly.
And so they're often shocked. They're like, well, what about all this I heard growing up? You know, I heard that it was like this and this and that, and it's not there. And I think they're probably sad, nostalgic, but at the same time, you know, Italy has changed and they haven't, instead of the other way around.
Exactly. Yeah. No, because they have, you know, my mother is living with us now. You know, she moved here last July from Florida, not far from where you are, from Jupiter Beach. And she still busts our chops like every single day. You can't cook for her. You just can't, because that's not how we did it. That's not how my mother did it. But it's not like how they did it when they were in Italy necessarily, even though some of that is true. But it was also how they did it when they were in Boston when I was growing up, because it didn't change. It was, they brought their traditions, and, you know, that's the way it's going to be.
Well, you know, the thing about it is nowadays, you know, some of those neighborhoods, in at least now I can speak for Chicago, and I was recently in Little Italy in New York, well, about a year or so ago. And, you know, of course, that's disappearing. It's being encroached upon by Chinatown. And, you know, you got this one little street now, Mulberry Street, that's about all that's left. You got a few restaurants. And so, you know, in a way, I think it's sort of a victory for the Italian-American experience, because, you know, the Italians, they never really wanted that to be the final destination for their children. I mean, that was for them to, like you say, to help them feel comfortable and still connected, you know, with their community. But they wanted their children to, you know, realize the American dream, and they moved on, you know, and so that's why it's sort of disappearing. Because the children and grandchildren of those at that initial, you know, wave did realize the American dream, and I think that their immigrant forefathers would be very proud of them for that.
Absolutely. So, the reason I asked also where your great grandfather was from is I just discovered maybe a year ago, 2 years ago. You know, I think most people think that Italians first immigrated to, you know, New York or Boston or Chicago, which isn't the case at all. You know, the first Italian immigrants actually went to Louisiana, to New Orleans.
Wow.
That was the first place that they landed in. And most people don't, you know, everyone thinks of New Orleans as, you know, Cajun, right? I mean, it's you know, Creole and Cajun.
French, yeah.
But they have a huge, huge Italian-American population and huge Italian traditions there.
That's interesting. You know, there are other pockets like that too. I know, you know, in Tampa, in Ybor City, there's a Sicilian population there that's mm-hmm. that goes way back. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the, you know, the wine growers in California, a lot of them came from Italy and brought, you know, the rootstocks from their hometowns. And in fact, when they had phylloxera plague, you know, mm-hmm. they had to bring a lot of those plants back to Italy to graft with the resistant plants right. in order to bring back the
Italian. Well, it's funny
Italian.
You say that because, you know, the biggest wine in – or the most popular wine in Puglia is Primitivo, right?
Yeah. Well, they call that Zinfandel in California,
there
right?
There you go. That's what I was going to say. Yes, very good. You passed the test.
Yes.
Oh, thanks. Well, yeah, it's the same grape, right? Genetically, it's the same grape.
Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, when the grape stocks were wiped out here, after the Italians brought them to California, they had to bring them back because, you know, they needed grape stock.
Yeah, I'm sure you guys have some great wine there. I mean, do you guys have a local favorite? Is there a grape
that we make in the house?
You're making your own wine. That's awesome.
We make it's a wine that is not at all known in the States yet. I don't think because it's very, very geographically limited. It's called the grape is called Uva di Troia, grapes of Troy. And so, of course, the, you know, the legend is that when the people who were lucky enough to escape the destruction of Troy from the Athenians brought grape stock with them when they came here, because also I think Hercules landed somewhere around here as well, according to legend or mythology.
To do what?
I don't know.
Wasn't one of the Seven Tasks or whatever it was?
Yeah, I think the Odyssey or whatever, one of those books.
That's not Hercules. You're well, not,
not. Oh, sorry. So tell me, what was it? Not the Odyssey. What was the other one?
Iliad and the Odyssey, but I'm saying, but Hercules wasn't part of those.
No, I know, but Hercules was part of another one of those.
He had to do like seven.
Yeah, so what's the name of the book?
Nothing. It's just Legend of Hercules.
No, there's a book. There's a book.
There was probably a Hollywood blockbuster, too.
Exactly. With Steve Forrest.
Yeah, really?
Remember Steve Forrest? No, you're too young.
No.
Steve Forrest was a big Tarzan guy. Yeah. He was one of the original Tarzans. I think it was Steve Forrest. But anyway, so Uva di Troia is the Trojan grape, and the wine that we make, or the wine that's very local here, is Nero di Troia, black Trojan, not to be confused with the condoms. But
right.
because, you know, the other funny thing about Italian language and Italians is that we have white wine, right, which is vino bianco, right? And then we don't have red wine. Now we do, but up until recently it was called vino nero. It's black wine. It was never called red wine.
So it was, in other words, it was a red wine from a very dark black grape, I guess.
No. All red wine in Italy up until probably 50 years ago was just called black wine.
Oh, 50 years ago. Because my Italian tapes from the 70s call it vino rosso.
No, it's vino nero.
The 70s, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't know that.
Speaking of traditions, I want to get into the main course here.
Steven wants to get into it.
No, because I think it's a fun, and Rick wrote an amazing blog post on this, guys, that I'll link to.
Rick is an expert on this.
He actually claims that he's not an expert, which he's right, but he wrote a really, really good blog post on this.
He says he's not an expert because he doesn't want the Vatican to come after him.
That's right.
But we want to talk about superstitions in Italy. And I think it'd be fun little conversation.
Stephen, when you write the notes for the blog, can you put in Stevie Wonder's Very Superstitious?
Oh, yeah. I want to. Very
to make that a background track or something.
Yes. the first. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, you kind of provided me with a nice little segue, I mean, because we were talking about mythology, and, you know, what happens, I think, in Italy, especially, and again.
Excuse me, Rick. Folks who are listening, he said mythology, not misogyny. That would be Donald Trump.
I did say mythology, but we could get into misogyny too, because that could be another topic. But
it's all the same.
the mythology and the superstition and the Catholicism, you know, sort of start to kind of blend into each other, where, you know, there's it's really hard to find a distinction. Because I talked about this post where I had, in fact, the name of the the post was Catholicism and other superstitions in Italy, because, like, for example, I was talking about the malocchio, the evil eye, and the way you can get rid of it. Well, there's this special prayer you have to say, and it has to be done by a grandmother who is a confirmed Catholic, and it can only be done on Christmas Eve. So, you're getting rid of this evil eye.
The actual ceremony can only be done on Christmas Eve, or she passes it on to somebody.
She passes it on Christmas Eve. Ceremony can be done, as needed, I think,
No, it's fascinating. The whole part you did, the follow-up about, so guys, backing up real quick, if you don't know, I did do a little bit of this on, I forget what podcast it was, about malocchio, which is the evil eye. All the Mediterranean cultures have a version of this. In Italy, it's
the Greeks especially, they have the blue blue and white.
Yes, it wards it off. So basically it's when somebody, it's not intentionally done, it's kind of usually unintentionally, somebody looks at you jealously or enviously, and then they give you this evil eye, which causes you
otherwise known as dirty eyeball.
Oh, really?
hairy eyeball, right?
All these formalities. And then basically, I thought your whole, you went into your second post, which was basically how you even determine if you have it and how they get rid of it. How they get rid of it was fascinating to me, the whole culture involved. And I don't know how you got somebody to spill the culture, or spill the beans on that one. It seems like that was
Yeah, I did a lot of research on that because, like I say, like you, we encounter these things as expats in Italy. And at first you're like, wait a minute, this is, this isn't serious, right? And this is like Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny or something, right? There are people who, I'm not sure if they believe it, but they certainly present that they believe it. And, my favorite one is when, the guy grabs his testicles when a hearse goes by.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So otherwise, if you don't, you'd be the next one to die.
That's right.
And I tell women, I said, well, the women are like, what are we supposed to do? I said, well, just, grab the nearest pair and apologize later because, you don't want to be caught by that.
I actually have somewhere here in my books, handwritten for me by a count in Parma, in Latin, where that whole thing of, there's something about the pubic hair on your balls. testicula mea. No, it's this whole thing. No, it's where the... No, Stephen...
No, go ahead. No, I'm just wondering about the Marcus.
Stephen's looking up at the ceiling like, oh, Paul's going to get disgusting now.
Well, now I have to mark this episode as explicit.
Okay? No, you don't.
Okay, go.
But it's an actual ancient Latin phrase that is the first one that talks about touching your scrotum to ward off the evil eye.
Right. Yeah, no kidding around.
Where did that come from? That's so weird.
Steve, I'm going to have to find it for you so you can put it in your blog notes.
Yeah, so I'll take a picture of it.
Yep.
Oh, Rick.
Yeah.
Hold on for one second. Before we go there, Rick, I'm sorry. Steven's giving me all these dirty looks. He hates when I interrupt.
You just go.
I've always wondered, because now Easter's coming up, where the whole Easter egg thing comes from.
Ah, well, that's a good question because, you can look at that from different ways. And we know that, Catholicism or Christianity, or you want to say, borrowed a lot from paganism. Mm-hmm. So there certainly was pagan rites involving eggs before Easter ever came along. So I do have a post on that as well on Easter.
But my take on it is completely different.
Well, let me hear it.
Mine is an economic reason.
Mm-hmm.
During the Middle Ages.
Oh, okay.
Lent, right? You couldn't eat meat for 40 days, right?
Right.
So eggs were considered a meat byproduct. So nobody could eat eggs. So the people who produced eggs were dying of hunger because they couldn't sell their eggs. So as soon as Easter approached, they actually did a marketing push to say that, oh my God, we can finally have eggs again. And that's where the whole painting of the Easter eggs came from and the push for these. Because, why else would a bunny carry eggs? It's like that never made any sense to me. Yeah, I can understand the bunny being fertility and the eggs also being fertility, but it has nothing to do with fertility from what I've read. It had to do with the fact that you could finally eat this meat byproduct again.
Let's see. I'm looking at this. So yeah, okay. Like you said, back to the Middle Ages, it was forbidden to eat animal products during mm-hmm. Lent. So they were blessed. So in later traditions, the eggs were blessed and given to the children as part of a custom called Benedictio Ovorium, centuries before the arrival of chocolate in Europe during the late 19th century. So I don't know. I don't really understand what that means. But, you know, what they do now with the eggs is great. You know, they have these big chocolate eggs. I know I'm sure it's down in Puglia too. But in Rome, and they put these things in there, and now they're getting ridiculous with them. I mean, so it used to be like a little toy. Yeah. But now people will,
we got a belt last year. A belt, or
an iPhone, exactly. Or you know, a Cinquecento. I mean, they're making them. They're making them pretty big now. But you know, they're an art form. I mean, they're beautiful. There's a place in Rome that's called Valzani that does them, and of course, every year they're overrun with requests for these custom eggs.
Yeah.
And they are truly works of art.
Oh wow!
So. Cool. I don't know if that has much to do with where they came from, but at this point, you know, it's certainly part of the tradition.
It always fascinated me. Fertility thing was always kind of a no-brainer, but you know, when I read this other thing about okay, that kind of makes sense too.
Yeah, right, and I'm sure that's part of it. But you know, there's all these things that sort of you know, evolve, and you know, who knows where they came from, like. Yeah. Let's see. Other curses. I talked about the one. Maybe when you guys got there, you're supposed to sweep out all the corners of your new house.
This one, the evil I hadn't heard that one.
Yeah, I mean, you got to get rid of all the evil spirits that had taken up residence of the previous owner. So you got to sweep out the corners of the house is real good. And of course, whenever someone dies, you have to cover up the mirrors in your house.
All right, but sweeping out the corners, is that the same thing as the Indian ritual of the smudge stick? Right? Is
it smudge? Yeah. Stick? I don't know. I think, as we were talking about earlier, I mean, the Italians are so obsessive with hygiene. I think it's just an excuse to do more cleaning around the house. Mm. But, I guess it's somehow it turned into a tradition and a superstition.
We actually have a friend here who has never and will never live in a house that has been inhabited by anyone else ever before. Because she's afraid that someone may have died in it.
Yeah. She's terrified of ghosts. Terrified. So you won't even take the risk that there's a ghost.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's...
The other one I thought that was interesting that you had, I didn't know this one. You can't, and we Paul and I are really sinners on this one. You can't throw bread in the garbage. I didn't know that one. Because bread is the symbol of Jesus.
So right. Have you heard this one, Paul?
No.
You have to kiss the bread first before you throw it away.
Yeah. No.
And that one actually, I'm surprised, Paul, you didn't hear. Well, you were born in Italy, but I think that's one of them that's still sort of endured in the Italian American households. You got to kiss the bread before you throw it away.
Wow.
The
one that I do remember very, very fondly that Stephen told me that you've also spoken about was. As a little kid, right? I was fatherless. My dad died when I was 2 years old, so I grew up with mostly women in the family, except for my uncle, the fascist, who was pretty cool actually. But as a little kid, like most little kids, you like to help Ma and Grandma do the household stuff, right? The chores.
Right.
So. My mother and my grandmother would, in the morning have to make all the beds in the house, right? Three generations of people living in the same house. So, of course, me as a little, 7-year-old would want to help make the bed. No, get away from the bed. Get away from the bed because if three people make the bed, the youngest one dies.
That's right. And then there's the other ones with putting a hat on the bed or putting a hanger on the bed. I've talked about those too. Yeah. Let's see.
We also did the newlywed couple. I didn't know that one. The newlywed couple, the two mothers should make the bed for the first time for the couple. I didn't know that one.
Yep. Yeah, it's supposed to bring, good luck in the bed, I guess. Like the two families are coming together and, they're going to...
A little bit, sort of.
Yeah, it's a little creepy. You're right. It's a little more, I think Americans would be a little put off by that because that's, it's getting your parents a little too close to your, bedroom activity.
But it probably has to do with the two mothers that have already had children. So it's all about fertility
again. I'm sure.
Oh, right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's about fertility. No doubt. And, they say they throw some coins into the bed too to bring good fortune.
Coins into your new car.
Right?
I know that.
Right?
Really?
Yeah, Italians do that, right? Right, Rick?
Yeah. Oh, sure, yeah. And what about the you have the St. Joseph. Isn't he supposed to be? Who is it that goes in the car? St. Christopher.
St. Christopher, because he's the patron saint of travelers.
Right. So he's supposed to go in the car. Right. St. Joseph is the one you bury in your front yard upside down.
Oh, okay.
That's if you're trying to sell your house.
Why is he upside down?
I thought it was a fig tree that you buried in your backyard.
No, if you want to sell your house, you bury a statue of St. Joseph in the front yard upside down. You know,
that one, we have to ask your mom about that one, because I'm curious if she knows that one.
Yeah, I'm sure she'll tell you.
Well, Paul didn't know this one. I mean, well, he didn't think it was true. When you spill salt, you throw it over your left shoulder.
Well, I didn't know that it wasn't true. I didn't know that it was an Italian thing.
Yes. And the Italians here, I've seen them. Whenever I do that, they look at me and say, how did you learn that? I said, well, I watched the Italian-American chefs on TV do it. So I picked up the habit. So now it's a habit. And he didn't think it was a real thing. And he just asked the woman tonight who's helping us here in the villa. And she's like, oh, yeah. When you spill the salt, you throw it over your shoulder.
I think it's also because, you know, salt in Italian history, going back to the Romans, is a very, very prized thing. I mean, did not want to waste salt. You know, our word salary comes from salt, because the Roman legions were paid in salt and, I believe, lentils, of all things.
Yeah. Well, I heard the reason you throw it over your left shoulder is you blind the devil who's on your left shoulder.
Hmm. That's a good one. I wasn't aware of the reasons for that, but of course it makes sense. Don't we all have a devil on our left shoulder and an angel on our right shoulder?
Yeah, because wasn't that in what was the movie with John Belushi? Animal House.
Right.
With the angel and devil on his
I think
shoulder.
Bugs Bunny did that one too, but I could be wrong. But
you know what? That actually helped. That actually always helped me remember what left was in Italian. Oh, Paul helped me with that one.
Sinister.
Sinister.
Sinistro. Good. That's right. That's a good one.
Yeah.
That's right.
So there are all those things. And, you know, I mean, the legends and the myths and the superstitions and the religion, I mean, you know, that's what fascinates me, is they all sort of get mixed together, and it really becomes hard to, you know, because I think Americans want to sort of separate those things, number one. Mm-hmm. And number two, they sort of want to, you know, believe something is true or not true. Whereas, as we were talking earlier, I mean, Italians sort of embrace interpretation, you know, whether it's religion or laws or whatever. There's always that gray area for negotiation. And I think Italians appreciate that. They appreciate the negotiation. They appreciate the keeping their opportunities open, you know, and that sort of thing. Where I think in the U.S., we tend to want to be more black and white.
Yeah.
And we want to sort of believe something is true or it's not. Yeah, right. Much more fact-based. Where I think there is this.
So where does the whole notion of, like, when you drop a utensil off the table, that company's coming?
That one, I don't know.
I heard that from my Asian partner. I don't know.
Italians do that,
Italian
too.
Italians
do it, too, yeah.
I don't know which one.
And the other one is the corna, right? The horn.
Yeah.
So,
yes.
So there are two versions of corna. One is good and one is bad. So the corna, which is a lot of Italian Americans and Italians, wear it on a gold chain around their neck, which is a hand with the two fingers pointing down, right? Mm-hmm. Which wards off envy, I guess, right?
The evil eye, right?
Yeah, Malocchio, yeah. And the other one is, actually, there are three forms of corna. There's the hand with the two fingers pointing down, which wards off the evil eye or envy. Then there's the corno, which is that little red, looks like chili pepper.
Right.
That you hang off your neck as well, or you put it in your house. But that, like a Buddha, has to be given to you by someone else. You can't buy your own.
Mm.
It has to be given to you.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is cornuto, or when someone makes you the corna, which is you're a cuckold.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's right. That's more of an adjective, and that certainly has negative connotations.
Yes.
And that's probably nothing worse than being cornuto in Italy. I mean, that's like the ultimate insult. I mean, the only way you can get worse than that is saying something about their mother. I mean, that's possibly the only worse insult. Except for
here in southern Italy, the worst thing you can say to someone is chi te murt.
Stay quiet?
Chi te murt, which is everyone who's dead in your family.
Ah.
But there's an even worse one.
There's a worse one, which is chi te murt e stramurt, which is everyone who's dead in your family and extra dead. Like, what is extra dead?
That's a good one. I didn't know that. So is that the dialect? I mean, because yeah. Mort obviously sounds like morto.
Yeah, morto. Yes, chi ti è morto would be in Italian.
Okay. Right.
So it's you're cursing the person's dead family
ancestry.
Members.
Yeah, right. Yes.
But stramurt is I don't know. I didn't know that there were levels of dead and extra dead.
Well, yeah, maybe if they're still doing their time in purgatory, they're.
Exactly. That's what I'm thinking, yeah.
Speaking of purgatory, when I was married and I had, I have three kids, I never baptized any of my kids, right? Because I was a monk for 3 years, and now I'm a recovering Catholic, but so my wife and I. She was Protestant. We decided not to baptize the kids into any religion because, being good ex-hippies, we figured they can pick their own religion later on when they want.
Right.
My grandmother couldn't believe it. She was like, what? What if something happens to them? What if something bad happens to them? Meaning, what if they die and they're not baptized? They won't go to heaven.
Right. Well, there's another side to that, which I sort of discussed in my blog post that Stephen was referring to, is that, I talked the story about being invited to someone's baptism, and I said, well, why are we going to his baptism? He's not even religious. And the answer that, my girlfriend gave back to me was because he believes it'd be bad luck if he didn't. So, bad luck, in other words, You're asking for it.
Yeah.
You're asking for it if you don't do it.
Yeah.
Number one. And number two, it looks bad. It looks bad to your family and to the community. So a lot of people do those sort of rituals, I think, more out of a sense of obligation or, mm-hmm. Appearances than any kind of religious reasons, And so it becomes sort of a way of keeping bad luck away, but also keeping the criticism away.
I think
away,
to your point, too, which is interesting, how much it mixes the religion and the superstitions kind of mixed together here a little bit more than a rabbit's foot in the States or a four-leaf clover. Doesn't it feel here it's a little more religion and superstition. It's interesting. It's weird how it kind of blends together to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, the rabbit's foot, in the U.S., I mean, it's... you may believe in it or not. I guess most people don't, but you never confuse it or mix it with religion. It's a separate
thing. Exactly.
Whereas in Italy they're the same thing. I mean, it's the same supernatural belief system with that kind of overlap on each other. So, bad luck and bad karma is the same thing. I guess so.
Speaking of religion and religious ceremonies that. I think maybe have gone by the wayside. I don't know, but because as I said earlier, I never raised my kids Roman Catholic. But growing up in Boston, I went through first confession, right, mm-hmm. which you had to do before you could receive first Holy Communion. And then when you did your first Holy Communion, you got dressed up in a suit and usually white, I believe, and. You had to wear the rosary beads around your hands, and you would go into the church, and big procession ceremony. And confirmation was after that, another big ceremony, sort of like a bar mitzvah, actually would be in Jewish. But I think, and people can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm not so sure that those things are still that big in the U.S., even with Italian Americans. Whereas here in Italy. I mean, they dress the little girls, especially. They dress them up like little virgin brides for their first Holy Communion. It's amazing.
That's true.
And they wear the dress for the whole week.
Yeah. Well, I think the U.S. is becoming a little more secular, but in Italy, it doesn't really have that that issue because. As I said in one of my other posts, I said Italy is sort of Rome or Europe in general was where they. Founded Catholicism, but also Illuminismo. So, I mean, these two things have sort of existed side by side for a long time. So, you can have both. You can, have these sort of, religious beliefs, if you will. Mm-hmm. It's more like religious traditions. I mean, in the U.S., I have a lot of Jewish friends who identify themselves as being Jewish, but they've never been inside of a temple after their bar mitzvah, and they don't go,
Same with a lot of Catholics.
Yeah, exactly. They have a strong cultural identity with their religion, but not necessarily a spiritual connection with it.
Yeah.
So, you know, you were mentioning, someone talked about some numbers. So, we consider 13 to be unlucky in the U.S., right. But in Italy it's considered lucky, while 17 is unlucky.
Exactly,
Friday the 17th was supposedly the day when Philip the Fair gave the order to kill the Templars or something. It's one of those things that goes back. And it's because the way it's written in Roman numerals, I guess the letters can be arranged to spell the Latin word meaning I have lived or implying that I am now dead. So 17 means death, I guess.
Which is why on Italian airplanes and Italian buildings, like in the U.S., we don't have the 13th row on an airplane or a 13th floor in a building. Italy, they actually eliminate both 13 and 17.
Right. Yeah. Italy and 13. Now, I have heard this one though, that people will say that 13 is unlucky at the dinner table because
of the last supper.
Whoever's the 13th guest, it's their last supper.
Judas.
That's right.
But you also talk about the number 29, which I didn't know that one. Is that more of a Neapolitan thing?
Yeah, that's Neapolitan. That comes from the Book of Smorfia, which they have a whole list of these dream interpretation numbers. And I don't really understand that entirely, but they a lot of people will use that book to play the lottery. So if they have a dream and they dream of a certain number, then they go play the lottery, you know. But 29 represents the male organ, so apparently that's lucky for some reason. So
how does 29 represent
the
male organ?
I was just thinking too. I'm sorry.
I don't know. They call it O Padre de Creature, so the father of creatures.
Really?
Because 18 would be closer,
It's funny too. You said creature, because then. In Italy, when you talk about a little kid, especially, you refer to that child as a creatura, a creature. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the U.S., we've lost sight of what creature really means, where it comes from, which is a creation. So in Italy, when they say a creatura, they mean God's little creation.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
but that's a better way to put it. I'm glad you cleared that up because I had that wrong. Obviously, I was thinking creature, but I think God's creation is a better way.
God's creation is what it really means. I took some people recently to Matera. I think it was last year, and we were talking about Carlo Levi's book "Christ Stopped at Eboli," which was I think it won the Nobel Prize for Literature as. Way back in, I don't know, the 50s, I think it was, or the 60s, talking about the poverty in Basilicata, which is the region next to Puglia. This woman, a Jewish woman who was in the van with us, she loved the book. She read it in English, and there was a huge mistake in the translation of the book. And I pointed out to her because she kept saying that, Carlo Levi talks about this poor Christian, and I said, well, that's a mistranslation.
That's right. She just means that man. She just means
that man. Exactly. Yeah. Because there was nothing else here. So, quel povero cristiano, that poor Christian, doesn't mean he's a Christian by religion, because that's sort of like what's the term?
Redundant?
Redundant, because everyone here is Christian except for Carlo Levi, obviously. But the old Italian word for person is a Christian.
That's right. No, and I still hear that in Sicily all the time. I spend a bit of time in Sicily, and that's an older person in Sicily. That would be the normal way to say it. Actually, that would it would be
povero cristiano, the poor Christian, or as we said earlier. Quella povera creatura, that little creature, but it's not a creature, it's that little God's creation.
Yeah, that's true. And, and that's subtle, but I think, growing up in that environment, hearing it, all that, that definitely has a, an effect on your cultural mentality and just, your personal mentality as you grow up,
Because it is all much more religion based than people. Think of everything in this country is really based on religion, and Italy is pretty much still a theocracy. I mean, the Vatican probably has much more weight and pull in Italian politics than any politician does.
But hopefully, yeah. Hopefully they don't with this new law that's going to be passed. So Paul and I can get married.
Oh, so is that up for vote? I didn't hear about that.
Yeah. It already passed the Senate. It's going to the House of Parliament, whatever. Yeah.
Well, I hope it does pass, but I tell you, I'll be surprised if it does. I mean, there's just so many politicians who, have to answer to.
But you know what? As much as we speak badly about the European Union, I think it's going to be sort of a U.S. kind of thing where, you know, you want to be part of the U.S., here's the law. You want to be part of the European Union, you know, we can't have one country, which is now really one state, have one law that says you can't be married or not recognized in another country that can. So sooner or later, it's going to have to be, you know, if somebody gets married in Germany or in England or in Spain and wants to move to Italy, Italy has to recognize that those two men or those two women are married.
Okay, so but then that doesn't necessarily mean that the civil ceremony can be performed in Italy at that point. Yeah. It's just a recognition of other countries.
But I think in the same way that other countries, you know, when Romania wanted to join the European Union and they had laws against homosexuality where homosexuals could be put in insane asylums, the European Union said, no, you can't do that. If you want to be part of the European Union, you have to like abide by some of the what we consider moral and humanistic codes that allow that to happen.
Well, we'll have to see. I mean, maybe it's already happened. I'm sure it has. How the Vatican has weighed in on it. So, you know, as you said, they have more power sometimes than the politicians. So, yeah. You know, that could be something to keep an eye on. Again, someone might just decide that it's bad luck more than anything else.
Are we getting ready to wrap this up?
Yeah.
My cousin, who is the two-time governor of Puglia, Nicky Vendola, he didn't run for a third term. I don't know if he could even. But he and his partner, Canadian partner, have created an enormous scandal all throughout Italy and most of Europe because they just had a child with a surrogate mother, which is illegal in Italy. You know, you cannot have a child with a surrogate mother, and you cannot, as a gay couple, you know, no one can have a child with a surrogate, whether hetero or gay, but as a gay couple, you can't adopt either. So they went to America, to California, and they had a child with a surrogate mother, and all hell has broken loose in Italy. And some of the nastiest things by politicians, you wouldn't believe what these people are saying.
So. Boy, that's unbelievable. I wasn't aware of that. But, you know, I can certainly see sort of the surrogate side of it from the church's /religious standpoint. Now, again, I'm not one of those. I'm a recovering Catholic. But, I think that, you know, I mean, that's something that they may be able to get a little more weight on than the gay issue because, you know, that's messing around with God's work.
They're all guessing on what will happen to this poor creatura, this poor child, when he's raised by two men and doesn't have a mother, because every child should have a mother, which, you know, to me is like, okay, so what happens when a child's mother dies at birth, you know, when she's giving birth, so the child no longer, or if you're so hell-bent on every child should have a mother, shouldn't you get rid of divorce? Because it's, you know, it's against nature, and, you know, and I said, oh, yeah, against nature? Don't forget, Italians, you put Galileo in jail.
That's right. Well, they finally apologized for that like 150 years later, didn't they?
No, more like 350
years later. 350 years later, I'm sorry, yeah. Because it was just John Paul II who finally pardoned him.
All
right.
Well, this has been great, guys. Listen, yeah, I mean, I appreciate you inviting me on your show today, and
we'd love to have you on
being
here
on
again,
mine.
Rick. You're wonderful.
And really, guys, really I'll have links to all his stuff. I think Rick, correct me if I'm wrong, but everybody can. The easiest place to find you is at rickzullo.com.
Yes, right, and that's my Italy blog, and my podcast can be found there as well. So that's sort of my hub.
Yep.
Great.
All right. Thank you so much.
Next time you're in Italy, come visit us.
Yes, definitely.
Okay. Sounds great, guys. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you so much, Rick.
Arrivederci.
Ciao.
Ciao. Ciao. Ciao.
So I'd like to thank Rick again for joining us for this podcast. That was a lot of fun. Hopefully you guys enjoyed it as well. Remember, you can find all the links to all of his stuff at livingvillacapelli.com/35. That'll have all the show notes with notes on this episode, as well as, again, all the links. And remember to hit subscribe on your podcast player so you never miss another episode. And when you're at livingvillacapelli.com, be sure to sign up for our newsletter, which, you know, every Thursday we send out. It gives you all of the news of the villas, along with tips and tricks and all kinds of good stuff and promotions that might be going on. So make sure you do that and keep up with us. And again, thank you guys so much. Arrivederci.